Welcome to Grounded Wellness. I'm your host, Bethany McDaniel, founder of Primally Pure, mom of three, and biohacking enthusiast. We created this podcast to bring you practical advice to live a more vibrant and intentional life rooted in long-lasting health. We record right here on our regenerative farm, grounded with our feet in the soil. Exploring bold truths, overlooked wisdom, and holistic tools that support true well-being. These conversations will challenge everything you know about health and wellness. Today on Grounded Wellness, I am joined by my brother-in-law, Farmer Rob. He's the founder of Primal Pastures, a dad of four, and a practicing physician's assistant. What started out with just 50 backyard chickens has grown into a full-fledged regenerative farm, raising the cleanest meat in America. This conversation will expose the corrupt, misleading world of meat labels, as well as the half-truths and straight-up lies that the meat industry doesn't want you to question. Free-range, organic, hormone-free, these labels are designed to sell, not to protect your health. Rob is pulling back the curtain and giving you the knowledge to shop smarter and eat cleaner. If you've ever felt confused at the meat counter, this episode is for you. Let's dig in. Rob, welcome to Grounded Wellness. We're here at your farm, actually. You own this place. Primally Pure has a small plot of land here, but this is the Primal Pastures farm, and I'm so excited for this conversation. We have so many fun, juicy topics to cover, but first, I think our audience would love hearing a bit about the Primal Pastures backstory from your perspective.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Super honored to be here. Primal Pastures started, it was 2012. We were sitting around the table at my parents' house, Easter dinner. And we were all kind of talking. It was your husband, my brother, my dad, my brother-in-law, and I. And we were sitting around basically talking about our different health journeys, complaining about all the misleading labels out there. And I thought we kind of came to a conclusion, well, all right, instead of paying all this extra money for these labels in the market and all these chickens that we're paying extra money for, well, we kind of came to a conclusion, it was my understanding, that we were going to raise our own chickens. So I left that conversation, went into the other room, did what anybody does. I went on Google and said, where do I get chickens? And I ordered 50 baby chicks to be delivered to the house. So I went back out like 30 minutes later. I said, all right, guys, I got the chickens. They're coming in 2 weeks. And they were all just dumbfounded. They were like, what? We've never even raised an animal before. Like, how are we going to raise 50 chicks? And I was like, well, we got 2 weeks to figure it out. And so knew absolutely nothing about farming at that time. Really, the whole purpose behind it was we knew we wanted to feed our family well, and raising the chickens was essentially the solution we came up with. And so we had 2 weeks to kind of put something together. We did what anybody at the time would have done. We went on Google, we went on YouTube, we watched videos, we watched all these people doing backyard farming, tried to piece together what we could. And in that 2 weeks, we were able to build a brooder to raise the chicks in. I had no idea, but chicks get delivered by USPS. So
I remember that. That was so shocking to me too. I remember like a few times I had to go there and pick up the chicks. It was so weird. Like walking into the post office and grabbing like a huge box of baby chicks.
Just chirping.
Yeah.
You'll never get better service at the post office than when they have chicks for you.
So true.
You get a front of the line pass.
Uh-huh.
They cannot wait to get rid of them. But yeah, 50 baby chicks showed up. We had built a brooder in the backyard in our shed, basically a tub with infrared lights to keep the chicks warm for the first 2 to 3 weeks. My dad at the time, he's always been into regenerative farming. He's been researching it for 30, 40 years. And so he was kind of the inspiration on what to do and a lot of where we gathered our information from. But with his knowledge, we built the brooder, and then Joel Salatin played a huge role in what we do. And he's what I consider the grandfather of pasture raised poultry. And so we built a pen, which was 2 feet tall by 10 feet by 12 feet with no floor on the bottom and just chicken wire on the outside to kind of keep the chickens protected and the predators out. And we said, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put 50 chickens outside on grass. We're going to feed them a soy-free organic feed, and we're going to move them to fresh pasture every single day. And that was the foundation of how we raised our animals. And we did that. And my brother-in-law, Paul, at the time, he was in his master's program at UCLA. And so he's always looking to the business side of things. And he's like, well, let's just tell people what we're doing on Facebook and see if anybody's interested. And within 2 weeks, we had a list of 100 people interested in these birds. We still hadn't even processed them and never even processed a chicken before. And Paul had already sold all 50 of them. So I remember vividly the night we decided to process. We had no money at all. We were completely bootstrapping all this. So my dad and I, for the processing equipment, we bought an old washing machine and converted it to a chicken plucker.
I remember
so
that.
we took it, cut the top off of it, got the rubber fingers, kind of put it in, had to change the spin cycle. And then for our scalder, because you have to dip the chickens in hot water to loosen the feathers.
After they've been already been killed.
After they've been killed, correct. We cut a water heater in half and converted an old water heater. So we were like the Beverly Hillbillies out there type of situation. And so we have this makeshift equipment. I remember my brother-in-law, Paul, holding up a cell phone camera on how to kill a chicken. And so we're watching this video, and my first experience processing was led through a YouTube video. And we went through those 50 chickens, sold all of them, didn't even get a try. One of the first batch, had no idea if they were even good. But we had a ton of people asking for more. So then we said, all right, well, let's raise 100 this time. Then let's raise 200 and then 400. And about that time, we're like, all right, we might be onto something here. Eventually we started adding other proteins, lamb, beef, pork, turkey, but essentially the entire business grew out of this tiny 1800 square foot house. 9 of us were living in it. And essentially maybe a quarter of an acre of grass in the backyard is what we started on.
Yeah, it's wild to think back on. I mean, I remember those days so clearly. People always ask, like, well, did you guys have a like farming background? Did you guys grow up in this? And it's so crazy to think how we literally pieced it all together from like Tom, my father-in-law, your dad's knowledge and YouTube, and then just enough family members like willing to chip in and help with different things. I mean, we literally had our entire family in the backyard and everyone had a different role in the chicken processing line. I mean, whoever like grows up thinking that they'll do that someday, I don't know. It wasn't fun, but I'm also grateful for that experience. Like being able to take a chicken from like a live bird to eating it that night for dinner is an experience that I'm forever grateful to have a part in. And Primal Pastures even used to offer that for the community, like chicken processing workshops. I mean, we're so disconnected from where our food comes from in today's day and age, but that was such a cool thing that you guys did to give people that experience.
It really is just an awesome experience. And we had people from all over the spectrum come out to that class. You would have big game hunters, people who have taken down elk, moose before, come out and say, hey, I just want to learn how to break down a smaller bird. To we would even have vegans come out and they're like, I really want to eat meat, but I don't feel like I can do it unless I'm willing to take the life myself. And it would be an emotional experience. And it is. Anytime you take a life to sustain a life, it's an emotional experience. But it was really cool to see somebody be able to come out and acknowledge that and take those steps. But it's honestly something that your grandparents, my grandparents did as kids in the backyard. They would have their laying hens, and when it was time, the hens became stewing hens, they would go out, they would wring its neck, they would process. Everybody just knew how to process chickens over 100 years ago. And with the Industrial Revolution, the Food Revolution, Agriculture Revolution, all of these things, we essentially lost track of that. And so this was just a skill everybody had at one point in time for thousands of years.
Absolutely. So this was about 12 years ago when Primal Pastures was just getting going. We were all living in this house. I was starting to experiment with skincare products at the time. I was using the kitchen a lot of times to make deodorants and body butters. I was rendering tallow from the farm to put into the products, like doing all these things that I never in a million years would have thought I would have done. And at one point, we also got a dairy cow, Mabel, and you and I had quite the experience on our attempt to milk Mabel. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh yeah, this is one of my favorites. So we finally got Mabel, and you and I had been wanting raw milk for a long time, mm-hmm. which was part of the reason we got a dairy cow. And so we just had no idea. This was essentially how a lot of Primal Pastures had, we'd call it failing forward. because we would do things and just learn from it. And so I know we just said, hey, how hard can it be? Let's just go. She had just had her baby, Fred. We had weaned him. And so we're like, all right, well, let's just continue to milk her. Had no background at all in dairy at all. So I think we went out there with a rope and a stool and a bucket, right? Just into the middle of the pasture. And I was like, all right, well, how hard can it be? And so Mabel was a super friendly cow. I thought we could do it. And I think we were out there for, I don't know what, like 3 minutes. And I maybe got maybe 2, 3 ounces of milk from her. She turns and gores me with her horn. And
In the
so
rib
in the
cage.
rib cage. So I'm like on the ground, just in excruciating pain. And maybe 10 seconds later, you get stung by a bee and you're horribly allergic to bees. And so I'm rolling on the ground, your face is swelling up.
But we didn't realize that it had stung me. So I knew there was a bee that was kind of like messing with me. I was kind of flailing around, like, and then I felt like what I thought might have been a sting, but then I wasn't sure because you said there was no stinger in
Yeah.
there, and I trusted you. But I thought maybe I hit myself in the eye with my wedding ring because I was like
Yeah.
fully like flailing, trying to get away from this bee. And so yeah, we didn't get much milk, but the bee sting ended up being terrible
Yeah.
because didn't know there was still a stinger on my eyelid. Went, got a massage with your sister, my sister-in-law, Jamie. I got out of the massage and the therapist looks at me and goes, "You need to go to the hospital." And I look in the mirror, my whole face is just completely swollen.
Swollen, yeah.
And I looked closer. I couldn't really see it myself. I had Jamie look and she was like, "There's still a stinger in there." And this was like 3, 4 hours
Hours
after the
after.
fact. So the stinger was still in there. We'll have to like show a picture
Yeah.
on the video of this because
Brave.
it was so bad. It was
Oh.
so bad. And my whole right eye was swollen for like, I don't know, it took probably 10 days for it to go down. It was a disaster.
Oh yeah. And we get questions all the time of when are you guys going to bring raw dairy to the farm? And I tell that story to remind people that it's probably not anytime soon.
It's not as easy as it
It's
looks,
not, no.
milking a cow. But yeah, we have a lot of these stories and fun times.
Yeah.
Glad they're in the past. But we have a lot of cool memories from those early days.
For sure.
Yeah. And you're a PA. So can you explain what a PA is and how you reconcile these two worlds in which you live? Because they're very different. Like you're a full-time PA and also the full-time founder and CEO of Primal Pastures.
Correct. Yeah. So I've been a physician assistant now for over 10 years. I work mostly in the hospital setting. So it's an acute care type of situation. Patients that are admitted to the hospital, whether it be trauma or exacerbations of their chronic symptoms, is mostly what I deal with. That spars quite a bit with what I do on the Primal Pasture side. The mindset behind both of them is to provide a service to help people. One addresses it kind of at the grassroots of it, and that's what Primal does in terms of we provide the cleanest meat in America. We try to produce the healthiest food that you can to provide a lifestyle that prevents you from ending up in the hospital where I would see you. On the other side of the spectrum, when I'm a PA, I get patients that maybe haven't had exposure to, all right, the standard American diet, the SAD diet, we call it, is what's putting you in this situation. And so I get to have those conversations with them in the hospital where I can explain things to them. I can show them things. Okay, your heart failure is directly correlated to what you're putting into your body. And to you and me, that makes sense. You know, obviously, what we eat affects the outcome of our body and how we perform. A majority of America doesn't understand that, especially the patients I see in the hospital. So I may share something like, you know, eating a microwave dinner every night isn't great for your health. And they're like, oh, but it was chicken and rice in the microwave dinner. I thought that was healthy. And so there's a ton of conversations there that really do kind of tie back into what I'm doing at Primal and are very beneficial. But overall, yes, two contrasting professions.
Are patients receptive to that when you have those conversations with them?
So, no. I've had some patients that have had their lives radically changed by information I've given them. I would say less than 1%, though. It's very hard to break those habits. And so you have these conversations and you just hope to plant a seed that will eventually grow, somebody else can water it, but at least give them the knowledge that, hey, there's other alternatives out there. But one of the most discouraging things about when I first started in the PA profession is patients would come into the office and I'd spend time with them and I'd talk with them and I would just be like, all right, you're on four or five medications. I would always explain, our goal is to get you off of these. Like, you shouldn't have to be on medications. These aren't solving the core issue. Let's find the core issue. Let's get you off these medications. And a vast majority of the time, they would be like, okay, can you just refill my prescription? Like, even when you broke it down and saying, this prescription, this medication you're taking is not fixing the problem. It's covering it up. It's taking care of the symptoms. And you could explain that, and they're like, okay, but can I just keep taking the medication? But it is rewarding because, you do get those patients who come in and they're like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that if I did this. And I mean, I remember one patient I'll always remember is a 30-year-old dude had Crohn's disease forever, his whole life. But he was like 30, 40 pounds overweight, ate terrible. I was like, have you ever considered what you're eating is affecting your gut health? And he's like, that would affect it. And I was like, absolutely. And so he ended up doing the carnivore diet for like 6 months, and he's never had a flare up since, and just completely got rid of it with his diet. And so being able to have those successful cases really encourages you and kind of keeps you doing it. But for the most part, the whole mindset, the American mindset, is what's the easy fix? What's the next fix? And so we see that in the hospital all the time, because that's one thing America does really well is tertiary medicine or like acute care. And so these people come in and they're super sick, and we can give them medications and get them feeling a whole lot better. And they just think that's part of the cycle instead of breaking the cycle, finding out what is actually causing those. And so we do get people feeling better in the hospital. We do give them medications and take care of it in the acute care setting. But in terms, once they leave the hospital, all those chronic conditions, it's up to them. There's not a lot that we can do with it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's frustrating, but worth it even if just a few people end up
Yeah,
listening.
absolutely. And I mean, there's been a radical shift, especially since, I would say, right around 2020, right around COVID, there's been a lot more people that are paying attention to what their health. I think the fear of COVID itself made people pay a lot more attention to what's going on in the healthcare industry and what they're doing to their body. And so I have seen a big shift, even in like doctors that I work with that have been in the industry for 30, 40 years. Some of them are going like, oh, maybe eating well and exercise. That's always how you start everything. So when I'm in PA school, every treatment was diet and exercise, and then if those things don't work, give them this medication. And so everything teaches you that diet and exercise, weight loss, all these things can be treated, but it's a blurb like that long, and then it's, these are the medications you can prescribe. And so it's frustrating, but they do acknowledge that obviously most of these chronic conditions can be taken care of just by changing your lifestyle habits.
What are some of the most misleading meat labels out there, in your opinion?
Yeah, so this is honestly, this is what started the whole Primal Pastures movement, is we looked into what the labels were and realized that they were all lies. And the one that is really frustrating, and I think it kind of starts all of the misleading labels, is the free range label. People are becoming more aware of this, but 10, 12 years ago, when you saw free range, you picture this. You picture wild pastures, you picture chickens outside on grass. A free range chicken to me is a chicken that's outside. That's what that sounds like. I believe that's what they're intending you to think. All free range means is, let's start with this. 99.9% of chickens in the US are raised in grow houses. So that's a 60-foot wide building that goes about 100 to 200 feet, sometimes 600 feet long, and there's anywhere from 5 to 30,000 chickens in that grow house. So that is your conventional chicken. You go to Costco, you get your rotisserie chicken, your 6-pound rotisserie chicken. It's raised in a grow house. That's your standard conventional chicken, which is fine. Call it what it is. But if you take that same grow house and cut a hole at the end of it, a 10-foot door, and have access to a concrete pad on the outside, you've given those chickens access to the outdoor, and now that's a free-range chicken.
Regardless of whether or not they ever use
Those
it.
chickens will probably never go outside, because most of these grow houses, it's 120 degrees outside. They can either stay inside in an air-conditioned barn, or they can go out onto a concrete pad. As long as they have outdoor access, it's considered a free-range chicken.
And their food and water source is also inside, so really they have no like biological desire to be outside.
Exactly. So if you're a chicken, it's air conditioned inside, your food and water's inside, why would you even consider going outside? It's designed that way.
And free range, cage free, are those kind of synonymous?
Yeah, so cage free in the last 5, 10 years has kind of gone out the window. California passed a law basically banning cages, and cage free mostly applies to eggs. Broilers were never really raised in cages, but they would put about 3 or 4 hens in a cage, like 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot, and they would just spend their whole life in there. They'd be able to stick their head out to get food and water, and when they lay their eggs, it would drop down, and it was atrocious conditions. And so basically lately that movement's been banned. They still put cage free on a lot of the labels just as a selling point, but a majority of chickens now are not raised in cages, but that's what cage free means.
What about hormone-free, antibiotic-free? Are those legitimate?
Yeah, so let's talk about hormone free first. For decades now, hormones have been banned from chickens. You have not been able to give chickens hormones. So if you see that, that's just somebody. It would be the equivalent of me saying, this is a water bottle, and then on this water, it's also water, but I say arsenic-free water. Arsenic's banned from water, but I just put it on there. It's obvious. That's the same thing as hormones. You can't feed hormones to chickens anymore. Antibiotics are different, though. Antibiotic-free, you would think, means the chicken went its entire life without antibiotics. That's not true. You can give a chicken antibiotics, but as long as you stop the antibiotics close enough to the time it's processed for it to not be in the system, then you can label that chicken as antibiotic free.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so if you go to the store and you're looking at an antibiotic free label, there's a good chance that they had antibiotics in their
And
life.
the whole reason they even need the antibiotics in the growth house setting is because of their living conditions. Like
Exactly.
the chickens raised out here don't even need that because they're not exposed to the same infections and crowding and all those things that can cause infections, right?
Exactly. And so if you've ever seen a picture of a grow house, it's basically a layer of chickens. You can't even see the floor. Under them is typically another layer of chickens that they're sitting on, and then wood chips. And so they're just sitting, and that's where they eat, they drink, they poop, they sleep. And so they're sitting in their feces for 4 or 5 weeks at a time. And that's the perfect breeding ground for infections. So viruses, bacteria. And so the way the system's been designed is these animals literally need antibiotics and vaccines to survive because of how atrocious the living conditions they're in.
What about organic chicken?
So organic does a little bit better job. If you're organic, you can't have any antibiotics at all. So organic does actually mean no antibiotics were ever given. But you take that same grow house we talked about earlier, and all you have to do is switch out the feed. So you put organic feed in there. Now you have an organic free-range chicken. It will never go outside. It's still living in its own filth. It's still piled on top of other chickens. I haven't even talked about the fact that in the grow houses, they have to sear the beaks off these chickens because their natural instinct is to pick and scratch and peck, and they'll pick and scratch each other because they have no grasses, they have no bugs and worms to eat. And so they have to sear off their beaks. They do that. That's still an organic chicken. Never goes outside once. You're paying an extra $2 to $3 a pound for an organic free-range chicken that's never left a grow house.
Wow.
Not to mention, organic doesn't eliminate corn and soy. Now, corn and soy are about 99% of what's fed to chickens in conventionally raised because they're cheap sources of grains. Soy is a great source of protein, but because of how much soy they're getting, it actually, once it gets into the meat and into the fat, it works as a hormone disruptor. So that was one of the main reasons we've never had soy or will never have soy in any of our supplemental chicken feeds is because of what soy does to the body. And these chickens are eating massive amounts of soy. And so if you are what you eat eats and you're putting a ton of soy into these chickens and then you're consuming them, you're going to see a lot of correlations to basically endocrine disruptors. So there's correlations with breast cancer in women, thyroid issues. And so we definitely make a point to not include soy in anything we do.
What about grass-fed when it comes to beef?
Yes. So grass-fed is another great misleading label. So every cow ever is going to be grass-fed at some point in its life. And so what do I mean by that? So essentially, when a cow's born, they'll be with the mom, cow-calf combo, and they'll feed off their mom for the first several months of their life. Once they get weaned, a lot of times they're still on pasture, they're out grazing, eating grass. But from 6 to 9 months on, they'll take them to a feedlot, maybe a year, and then spend the next 3 to 5 months fattening them up on corn and soy in a feedlot. But when you sell that cow, because it did eat grass, you can label it grass-fed. So it may spend the last 4 to 6 months of its life eating nothing but corn and soy in a feedlot. That is a grass-fed cow. So now people are changing it to grass-fed, grass-finished, because that kind of indicates, okay, in my head, they're finishing them on grass as well. But that's misleading as well too, because in these feedlots, they're still getting corn, they're still getting soy, but then they drop in some grasses too. And so it's still a confined animal eating corn and soy, but that is a grass-fed, grass-finished cow. So can you really trust that label? No. Is there a sure tail way to know how your animal's raised? Not without really knowing your farmer and where your beef comes from.
Yeah, and similar with 100% grass-fed then, I'm
Yeah.
assuming.
So 100% grass-fed will at least mean they didn't get corn and soy.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they weren't in a feedlot for the last 6 months just getting grass pellets.
So basically what you're saying is it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to find really clean, quality, well-raised meat in the grocery store. What would you say is like the worst out of all of the factory farmed meats, or even some that maybe they have some of these labels that mean like a little bit like organic. Like, what would you say people should just avoid across the board when it comes to meat shopping in the grocery store?
Probably the three that I would say absolutely avoid are farmed fish, pork, and chicken in the grocery store.
Farmed fish, what are the issues there?
So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the way fish are farmed in the ocean. They basically have these giant, I mean, they call them farms, but it's these giant nets in the ocean where they have tens of thousands of fish. It's like a grow house, but in the ocean. And these fish are just swimming around in this confined area, getting fed absolute trash that's just dumped in from the top, and they're pooping on each other. The amount of parasites in the fish, this is all store-bought fish that you're gonna, and so farmed fish is absolutely terrible for
And
you.
they're also fed corn and soy, right? Which
Absolutely.
is such an unnatural feed
For
for
fish.
something that lives in the ocean.
Exactly.
And then I've also heard that they can be fed food dyes, that there can be food dyes in their feed so that they have, like salmon, for example, might like they might be able to replicate that orange color that they get in nature
Yep.
from eating the algae and such with food dye in the feed.
Have you seen a salmon or a tuna without the artificial dyes?
I
So
think so.
salmon is like white.
Yeah,
It's
super pale.
awful.
Yeah.
And so tuna the same way. Now what they do with tuna, and we've done a reel with this before, is they use carbon monoxide to turn it that dark red color that tuna should have. And so you could take like a store-bought tuna and it starts to get like pale and stuff and put carbon monoxide on it and it gives it more red. And so that's actually a thing they're doing before they sell it, is they basically gas it to have this color and then they sell it as tuna in the grocery store. It's awful.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they do the same thing with eggs, right? Because I think by now people know that naturally an egg yolk, it should be orange, it should have this rich color, and people are replicating that in unnatural ways.
Yeah. And so that was one thing 10 years ago when we started. You could tell a good pasture-raised egg because of the color of the yolk, and the yolks were never like symmetrical. And so you would have, based on what plants are eating around in the pasture, you would have some that were real dark orange, some, you would have a variation. And so one thing they figured out is they could feed like marigolds to conventional egg layers. So in the grow house, they would put marigolds and a couple other things in their feed, and it would give them that darker orange. And so if you're selling a free-range chicken and they got a darker orange yolk, customers feel good about it because that's what they had been trained. But now, fast forward 10 years later, people are starting to catch on. All right, they've figured out ways to manipulate the way an egg looks. But if you've cracked open like a pasture-raised egg. It looks like a proud egg. It's got the yolk that sits up off the egg, whereas like a store-bought egg, if you get a conventional factory-raised egg, it's kind of, the yolk just kind of sits flat. I almost think of like an egg McMuffin, where it's just smashed. But when it has the right protein content, the right amino acids, you're going to see that yolk sit up on top of it. And big ag is always going to find a way to mimic what nature does really well, and they're going to try and replicate that the cheapest, easiest way possible.
So the best thing people can really do is to know their farmer personally, to
Yes.
visit the farm, to know the practices.
If you go to the grocery store and you see a brand and they don't have a website with live footage of their farm or pictures of their animals, stay away from it.
Yeah. And I try not to eat like any conventionally raised meat, but if I have to, if I'm at a restaurant, they don't have great options, or at the grocery store, if I'm in another city or whatever. I feel like beef is gonna be better. Like conventionally raised beef is gonna be better than like conventional chicken or, pork or fish, like you just mentioned.
Yeah, and for a couple of reasons, cattle are bigger animals. It takes longer to grow out, so they do have to do a better job with, I mean, confined beef lots, confined feeding operations, they're still sitting in their feces. They're still not great, but beef overall is a better option at the store than a factory farm chicken or pork or fish.
Yeah, because at least they were outside
Right.
for a portion of their life. I
Exactly.
mean, probably all of their life, but in a feedlot for
Yeah.
the last part, if not all of it.
Right. If you had to choose, I would definitely say beef over the other three.
At a high level, what differentiates the way you do things here at Primal Pastures compared to other farms?
Really, our whole goal is to mimic the way nature intended the animal to be raised. We want our chickens, our pigs, our turkeys, our beef outside on pasture. We want them eating a natural, basically what they would eat in nature to the best we can. So for ruminants, they're supposed to eat grasses. Our lamb, our beef, that's all they eat. They eat grasses. They're outside from the time they're born till the time we're processing them. They're outside foraging. Our pigs and our chicken, they are omnivores. So we do give them a supplemental feed. What we do is we've eliminated all corn and soy. We do supplement them with certified organic feed, but that's mostly peas, milo, barley, and then like diatomaceous earth, a couple rocks to help them digest it with the gizzards. But that's a majority of what they get in their supplemental feed, and we avoid corn and soy like the plague.
Yeah, I don't think most people realize that even pasture-raised chicken requires some supplemental feed, or else the bird would never grow beyond what, like 1 or 2 pounds.
Right, exactly.
And so, what you guys do that's different is that it is super pure and it also doesn't have any seed oils. And you guys had to really go to extreme lengths to find feed or create. I think you even worked with a mill to create your own blend that didn't have seed oil. So, how does that impact the finished product?
Exactly. And so one of the things corn, soy, and seed oils, a lot of times it's soy oil or corn oil that they put inside the feed. We worked super hard with our mill to get olive oil put in and any seed oils taken out of it. And so we've been doing that for about 3 or 4 years now and super excited about that. But essentially, the reason we do that is because of the polyunsaturated fatty acids. And so putting those seed oils into the feed, the chickens are going to eat that. That's going to go into the meat. That's going to go into the fat. And then when you eat that, obviously you're consuming those. And so we always say you are what you eat, eat. And so we wanted to take out anything that we wouldn't eat ourselves. We really don't want to feed the animals that we're going to be consuming either.
On a nutritional level, is there a difference, a measurable difference in birds that are raised this way, eating quality feed versus a conventionally raised chicken?
Absolutely. So there's a ton of data out now to support pasture-raised chicken over a conventional raised chicken. And one, it just makes sense. They're outside, they have way more access to different plants. Animals are intuitively smart. They know what they need. You watch a cow grazing, you watch a chicken out picking, scratching. They'll go and eat a certain leaf if their stomach hurts. They know what's going to make them feel better. They know what they need. They know what nutrients come from each plant. And so just giving them access for the chicken to express the chickenness of itself. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but just putting them outside in their element to where they can be a chicken, they know how to take care of themselves. And because of that, you create a robust immune system in that animal, and you don't need things like vaccines and antibiotics.
Another thing that sets Primal Pastures birds apart is that your chicken isn't vaccinated. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, so like we've talked about in these conventional grow houses, they've created an environment that these animals really can't survive without vaccines and they can't survive without antibiotics. And so they're in a situation where these birds' immune systems are so weak and so poor that if they don't get vaccinated, they could have Merrick's disease just wipe out 20,000 birds just rapidly. And so they have to preemptively vaccinate and give antibiotics to these birds just to keep them alive. We actually have to pay extra to get our birds taken off before they vaccinate the birds. So sometimes they spray the eggs with the vaccine before they even hatch, in ovo is what they call that, or sometimes as soon as they hatch, they're vaccinating them. And so we actually pull our birds off. And it's not that we're saying we're anti-vaccine or anything like that. Our birds don't need it. So you have diseases like Merrick's disease, Newcastle disease, these diseases that can just wreak havoc on conventional raised birds, but because our birds are outside, they're on grass, they get fresh air, they get moved to fresh pasture. So when they poop, they're not sitting in their feces. So if there's any of that virus or anything there, they move on to fresh pasture that next day. The other thing I want to talk about is the one thing that kills viruses and stops them from replicating and infecting is ultraviolet light. And so if you raise your animals outside on fresh pasture, the sun's doing all the vaccinating we needed to.
That
And
makes
so
so much sense.
it kills the viruses. And so we've been doing this for 12 years. We've never had an outbreak. We've never had an issue with disease on any of our animals.
You had a viral reel about how most chickens, even organic ones, go through a bleach bath during processing. Why do they do that?
Honestly, it's the conditions they're raised in. You have so much bacteria on these birds, so Campylobacter, Salmonella, if they don't dip them in a chlorine bath or a bleach bath, then a lot of times they won't be healthy enough to eat. Like you'll have bacteria grow on these, the product won't last long, people would get sick. And so it's very standard practice for most of these places to dip them in a chlorine bath.
So is there an alternative for that?
So there is, and it's actually what we do. Again, we have not had any issues with disease burden or anything like that. So we actually use a vinegar bath. You can also use like hydrogen peroxide. When we were processing in our backyards, we would just take capfuls of vinegar, put it in the chill tank, dunk them in that, and that took care of it. But when you have conventional raised birds that have such high disease burden, that's what they have to use.
Did the bird flu epidemic impact you guys at all? How did you navigate that whole thing?
Yeah, so again, all of our birds are raised outside. We haven't had any issues with that. Honestly, I think most of the bird flu epidemic was manufactured. The way they handle it, I don't agree with at all. Essentially, my thought process would be if I have a flock of chickens that get infected with bird flu and they're dying, I would take the ones that survive that and breed them because they have built-in immunity. That makes sense to me. And so what's happening is you get these flocks of 30,000 egg layers and 10, 20 of them test positive for bird flu. Instead of letting that take place, what they do is they just go into these grow houses, they pump this foam up, suffocate all 30,000 of them, and just kill them all. And so they manufacture this crisis where really, if you raised animals the appropriate way, where they can have a robust immune system and they can fight this off, none of that would be necessary. And you could take the ones that actually have that built-in immunity, breed from them, and then the virus doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a logical solution. And it's not even passed through consuming animals that have it. So the only cases have been with farmers coming into direct contact with the animals because it's a respiratory disease and not something that impacts the digestive system or that's contracted through eating the infected animal, or at least there haven't been any documented cases of that.
Right.
I want to talk about tallow because you guys just started producing your own tallow and we are actually starting to use it in Primally Pure products. What are the nutritional benefits of consuming tallow?
Yeah, so tallow's awesome. It's a superfood in itself, but it's not just that. Obviously, you know better than most the benefits of applying it to the skin. But tallow, when you think of where tallow comes from, we use 100% suet, which is typically the fat that comes around the kidneys. It's the cleanest fat. It's got the best nutritional profile of the fat in the body. And so we selectively source suet for our tallow. That provides a huge amount of your fat-soluble vitamins. So vitamins A, D, E, K, all of those are robust in tallow, especially if you use grass-fed, grass-finished, pasture-raised cows. The reason it's much better in grass-fed, grass-finished cows is because all of those vitamins are getting pulled from what they're eating. If you're taking tallow from a cow that is stuck in a feedlot and it's only eating corn and soy, a lot of those toxins, a lot of that soy gets stored in fat. So now you're rendering that fat down, and then you're using that for your tallow, which is not great. And so for us, we want to make sure that it's sourced from the best cows that we can, raised outside on pasture, grass-fed, grass-finished. We use the highest quality of fat from the suet, and then we render that into the tallow, which you're using. But not only that, you can use it to bake, you can use it to baste, you can we love frying in it.
Yeah, it's super heat stable,
Yeah,
so
the
really good for high temperature cooking.
exactly. Yeah, so the oxidization level is very high. And so if you've had French fries cooked in tallow compared to French fries cooked in vegetable oil, it's night and day. That's why McDonald's was famous for French fries for so long, is because they used tallow. And then they changed to vegetable oils. They started adding, beef seasoning, different things to try and get that flavor back. But tallow is really what gave it the true flavor.
Okay, another animal-based superfood is liver. As we both know, what are the benefits of consuming liver?
So liver will always have a special place in my heart, and I'll tell a quick story real quick. I got COVID in 2020, and I went a year without being able to smell. It was a completely dwarfed smell. And after about a year, I decided to go strict carnivore diet. And I did that with liver. Every single day, I was doing about 1 to 2 ounces of liver. Within 3 days of that, my smell came back.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I started researching that. I was like, all right, liver is essentially nature's multivitamin. It's the most nutrient dense food you can consume. It's got, like we talked about, much higher levels of the fat soluble vitamins that you get in tallow, so A, D, E, and K. And especially if you get it from grass-fed cows. So vitamin A, retinol, super huge for vision, immune system, your skin. Vitamin K, actually, from grass-fed cows, there's a study I was just reading recently that takes calcium, and if you get grass-fed cows, it takes the calcium out of the arteries, which a lot of times causes heart disease, and uses it throughout the body, puts it in the cells where it's supposed to be. These are all benefits of grass-fed liver, grass-fed tallow over conventional raised.
How were you consuming the liver when you were eating 1 to 2 ounces per day?
So this is my goal was to insult my senses any way I could. So I was literally just eating it raw,
Oh my
and I
gosh.
wasn't blending it up. I would just
Stop.
take 2 ounces of raw liver and just chew it,
Oh.
and just I couldn't smell or taste.
Yeah.
And so by day three, I was like, oh, what? This is terrible. Like when it kicked back in,
Yeah.
and I was like, but I had done it for 2 or 3 days, so like the texture didn't really bother me. I was kind of used to that, but I couldn't smell or taste it. It was just kind of chalky. And so I did like 2 weeks, and then after a week and a half, I just started drizzling it with some honey. And then finally, after doing that for a month, I was like, all right, well, I know you are notorious for your liver smoothies. I was like, all right, let me start mixing it into smoothies, because my wife and kids wouldn't touch it. But once I started stealing your recipe and putting it in smoothies, the family loved it.
I'm laughing because I'm remembering the picture you sent to the family recently when you made the liver smoothie and you like for did you forget to put the lid on? What
Yeah.
happened? And it just like Rob sends this picture of like he's standing next to the blender and there's just liver smoothie all over him, all over the kitchen. It was a disaster.
Yeah, so I didn't think it was sweet enough, so I wanted to put some of our honey in it. So I took the top off and didn't think to put the top back on. And so I poured the honey in, turned it on, and before I could even, it just erupted over the entire kitchen. And I was just covered from head to toe. And I spent 30 minutes scrubbing my kitchen because I forgot to put the lid back on.
Oh, that's terrible. So we actually have liver smoothies here. Normally I make them, but my sister-in-law, Jamie, Rob's sister, made ours today.
Yeah.
Should we try it?
Cheers.
Cheers. This is really thick. I need a spoon.
It's more of like a acai bowl
Yeah, it
thickness.
is. It's good though.
It is good.
She did a good job.
I like the mint she took from the farm. That's a nice touch.
Oh, probably have it all over my teeth right now. What about other organ meats? Do you have any other favorites? Have you tried any other ones?
So when it comes to organ meats, I'm a firm believer in you should consume what you're deficient in. So if you're somebody that struggles with thyroid issues, we call them sweetbreads and cows. I think you should consume that. I think there's a huge benefit to consuming an organ meat that you're deficient in.
And that's like an ancestral concept too,
Correct.
right?
Yeah, that's not something I came up with on my own. That was standard practice up until the early 1900s. And so I really like beef heart, chicken
Heart
hearts.
is actually so mild. I haven't tried beef heart, but chicken heart. Like I remember when we used to have chefs come out and do meals, and a few times we had chefs that would use the heart and they would just put like little chicken hearts onto a skewer, and it just kind of tasted like steak.
Exactly. And it's very, I mean, it is a muscle. The heart is a muscle. So
Yeah.
it honestly, if you took beef heart and cooked it just like a steak, the only difference I think you would notice is it's just a little tougher.
Yeah.
It's just a little firmer. But
But nowhere near the strong taste of liver.
nothing like liver.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think liver is probably the most insulting one
And the
when it
most
comes to fish.
nutritious.
Yes, exactly. And I love liver. I eat it all the time, but it's definitely an acquired taste.
What about bone broth?
Bone broth is huge, and for a number of reasons. I don't think a lot of people understand how important it is for gut health. So when you take healthy bones, healthy joints, you melt down, you get that cartilage, you get all of the essential amino acids that come from the bone marrow as well. But that goes in, and a lot of times people who have leaky gut syndrome, they can heal that with bone broth. And so super important. It's great for your immune system. It's great for digestion. Especially with the studies coming out linking like leaky gut syndrome to mental illnesses and depression, anxiety, things like that. I can't recommend bone broth enough.
Good for the skin too, all that collagen.
Oh yeah.
And you can also get the collagen in chicken skins, right? That's why I love the Primal Pastures chicken, like ground chicken blends. Well, they're delicious, but also like they're so gelatinous because you guys grind up the skin and
Right.
everything, cartilage, all of that ends up in there, right?
Oh yeah.
And they're really good. Raw milk. Are you a fan of raw milk?
Huge fan of raw milk. This is another one that's a no-brainer to me. If you take something in its natural state and you enjoy it, you get the benefits of it. It makes no sense to me that you would heat it up, kill basically everything living in it. I mean, I understand why they do that because the cows that are getting the milk live in horrendous conditions, and if you don't do that, you run the risk of severe disease. But if you're getting it from Mark McAfee, if you're getting it from a respectable source that is doing appropriate hygiene practices, the benefits of raw milk are so much better than processed milk and homogenized and pasteurized milk. And so if I've had patients come in and go, "Oh, I'm lactose intolerant, I can't try it." I was like, "Okay, well, have you tried raw milk or A2 milk?" And they're like, "No," and they can do that and they can tolerate it because when you process milk and when you pasteurize it, you get rid of the lactase, which is an enzyme that actually helps a lot of people digest lactose. And so when you have it in its natural state and the way it's supposed to be, a lot of people that have lactose intolerance do much better.
Yeah, it's a completely different food, pasteurized milk versus raw milk.
I mean, it tastes like water versus not water. I mean,
What it should
yeah,
taste like.
exactly.
Yeah. What would you say to someone who loves the idea of eating higher quality meats, really wants to, but they're hesitant to pay a higher price point for it?
Okay, so that's a great question, and we get this question all the time. It's super important to understand how people spent their money over the last 100 years. So prior to the agricultural revolution, a majority of people's money was spent on food, and very little was spent on medicine. Now you're seeing this shift where a lot of people spend money on healthcare, chronic diseases, and they're spending less and less money. So there's a shift where if you focus more and invest in your health ahead of time, you may have to spend more on food, but in the long term, chronic illnesses that cost a ton of money down the road can be avoided. And so, yes, to get nutritious, high quality food does cost more, but I think there's a trade-off in that too. And I also want to address there's ways to get nutritious food at a lower price point. And I always recommend people buying in bulk. So if you're looking to stock your freezer, hey, I know it's more to get this nutritious food. I know the benefits are there. What's the best way to do it? So I recommend getting a quarter cow, buying a half cow, because you get all your cuts at the same price. And so where typically you may have to pay a ton of money for your ribeyes, your fillets, you get those other cuts too at a cheaper price. And so your fillets, your ribeyes, your ground beef, all of that's coming in at a cheaper price. And so I recommend that. The other thing you can do is the nutritional value in steaks is very similar. And so if you're concerned about your health, buy a top sirloin instead of a ribeye. You don't have to buy the most expensive cuts to really get the nutritional benefits.
That's good advice. Rob, I asked Paul, our brother-in-law, when he came on, the same question too. But you have four kids, two full-time jobs. How do you personally take care of yourself and still show up well for all the demands that you have on a day-to-day basis?
Majority of it is my faith in my family. I have an unbelievable support system. My wife's a rock star. She just is on top of it always. And so that's a huge support. Obviously, our extended family is super helpful. I have three sisters and a brother that live right around town, my parents, my in-laws. And so we have a ton of family support. We have a church that backs us. And so having that foundation lets me push harder and further. And one thing that I always emphasize on top of that is exercising. I have to get into the gym. I don't have time to plan out workouts. And so I work out at a local CrossFit gym. I show up, the workout's done. I spend an hour, work my butt off, and I'm out and I'm refocused. All the stress and anxiety throughout the day is balanced, and that plays a huge role in it too.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Ditto. We call it the McDaniel shuffle sometimes because there's like always like ongoing conversations on the text thread, like, oh shoot, can someone pick up this kid from this place at 3 o'clock? Or like, I forgot about this. Can someone help me with this thing? And someone is usually able to chime in and provide support, and it's so valuable for me as well. I mean, we all have busy lives and we all like things are just kind of always in motion for all of us.
For
And
sure.
so having that built-in support system is huge.
Yeah.
Rob, thanks so much for being here. Where can people find you and Primal Pastures?
Awesome. Thanks for having me. We ship to all 50 states. It's just primalpastures.com. One of the best things is the convenience that we offer. You can have the cleanest meat in America shipped right to your door. Little effort and great quality.
Yeah.
We're on Instagram, we're on TikTok, we're on Facebook. Follow us. Really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Rob.